justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
Listening to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Robin Fadden. It's just after 6 p.m. on December 21st, and this is our last show for 2022 before we come back in the new year. So since In the Motherhood is a show about parenting from a feminist perspective, it encompasses many topics and ideas. On today's show, we hear from Montreal columnist, writer, and news producer Tula Dramonis, who talks with us about her new book, We the Others, Allophones, Immigrants, and Belonging in Canada. You might recognize Tula's name from her writing on politics, social justice, and women's issues for national and international publications, as well as more recently, Montreal's Cult MTL. In her book, We the Others, she brings those political and social issues together with stories of her own family and others' experience of immigration and life in Quebec. And that's basically what we talk about in this conversation. We talk about everything from personal experience to immigration politics and language politics. I'll play that conversation right now. So thanks for listening to CKUT and In the Motherhood. Hi, Tula. Thanks so much for being here. Welcome to In the Motherhood. First of all, I'd like to focus on how your book highlights intergenerational issues related to immigration, including how children and young people balance their lives in Quebec. So starting out, as you, a hyphenated Canadian, as you write in your book, you've been thinking about immigration and its effects on families for much of your life, and you've experienced it firsthand. So immigration is a personal issue to you. In We the Others, you tell your family's story, and you also debunk some myths that some people hold about immigration and immigrants in Canada. How long have you been thinking about writing this book, and was there a spark that ignited the writing process for you?
The reasons why I wrote this book are very personal. My dad passed away. It'll actually be tomorrow. I was thinking about him last night. It'll be tomorrow. Will be 9 years since he passed away. I was mourning him. I was thinking about his life, a very typical kind of first generation Greek immigrant life here, and worked really, really extremely hard with my mom to give us better opportunities. Very typical. Both of my parents didn't have a lot of education. They worked extremely hard in the restaurant business. I grew up surrounded by it, and I am very familiar with the sacrifices. And a lot of these sacrifices involve their own family. You know, they don't get to see them as much, and they don't get to see their kids as much as they'd like to, or they're always tired. So the reasons were very personal. My dad passed away. I was thinking about his life. And at the same time, a lot of this anti-immigration rhetoric was kind of ramping up around me. The CAQ was elected, you know, was campaigning the first time around 5 years ago, 5, 6 years ago. You could start hearing a lot of what they were saying, and their main platform was decreasing immigration. That was one of the main parts of their campaign promises. Trump had been elected south of the border. In Europe, we were seeing a lot of different governments, you know, Hungary. You know, this anti-immigrant rhetoric was kind of all over the place, and definitely here. This is where I live. This is where legislation impacts me directly. This public discourse impacts me directly. And I took it very personally. It's impossible to be first generation or second generation or even third generation and not take some of this, of what we're hearing, not take it personally. How can you not? So that was one of the main reasons, I guess, I reacted, in part because I wanted to talk about my dad's legacy and about my parents in that first generation, and kind of dispel a lot of myths about how hard immigration, you know, immigrants work, and they don't take advantage of the system. It's really a win-win, you know, like for everyone. Like, yes, immigrants, of course, benefit when they go to a new country with new opportunities, but they bring so much as well to the table. Like, this notion that they are the only ones who gain is absolutely absurd to me. And I wrote it out of frustration because of what I was hearing around me. You know, I needed to set the record straight.
And that really makes sense, though. I think about that often where I live in the Montreal neighborhood of Park X.
One of the most multicultural, if not, I believe it might be the most multicultural neighborhood in Montreal.
It is. And when you talk to people on the street and in stores about their experiences, they'll often be positive, but feel like they're still pulled between two or more worlds. It's like they're recognizing the opportunities they have, but they're also feeling this sense of loss. It's like sadness and happiness, frustration and hope all at the same time. And that's a feeling that goes back decades, like in the story of your father that you tell in this book, who immigrated to Quebec from Greece.
Yeah, it was really emotional for me writing those chapters. And honestly, like, even though I've given a lot of readings so far while promoting the book, there are certain chapters that I don't read because I'm too afraid that I'm just going to turn into this like bumbling mess and start crying, because it still feels very fresh to me, you know. And those are very personal, those emotions and that feeling of describing how difficult it was for my dad and my mom when they first got here. Those are very real experiences, you know, of loss and confusion and this cultural kind of shock and linguistic shock that, yes, is very specific to my parents, but is very much the experience of almost every immigrant, regardless of what their ethnic background or linguistic background is, right? And it's been amazing to me while promoting the book, because a lot of people have come up to me, and it doesn't matter, like, they're not, of course, a lot of Greeks, you know, people from the Greek community are coming up and saying, oh, this is cool that you're talking about the Greek community. But I think anyone going into the book thinking that I'm only talking about the Greek community is going to be very surprised, because I don't. It's part of my identity. But it's one of my many identities. And for me, it was really important to explain and to show that, first of all, the process of immigration is very similar across the board, regardless of what your background is, regardless of whether it's 1950 or whether it's 2022. That first generation experiences pretty much, I'd say, 95% of what I talk about, maybe in different, you know, because we can't generalize, obviously, like someone who comes in with a PhD is not going to have the same experiences as my dad came in when he came in, you know, as a manual laborer, right? And worked very different jobs. But again, I've also spoken to immigrants who have those double masters and PhDs who are working at a supermarket and are working at the dollar store and are working at, you know, as busboys in restaurants, because A, they're having a hard time having their degrees recognized. And second of all, it's just what immigration is. It's a hard process, you know? People often won't give you a chance, or they'll hear an accent or a strange foreign name, or they'll think that your degree from Egypt or from Lebanon doesn't have the same validity, and you need to kind of, it's really you're starting your life all over again. You're reinventing yourself. And the process is, yes, like you mentioned, a hopeful one, but it's a very difficult process. There's a lot of loss involved. You know, you are losing your sense of identity, the things that make you who you are in some respects, like the things that you're proud of. You're starting from scratch. You are losing your family, your references, the country that you love, everything that around you that you're familiar with and your sense of belonging. And you're just thrusting yourself into this completely new world where, if you're lucky, people will help you and recognize you as another human being who deserves a chance, or you'll be treated as an existential threat or a menace or a source of violence and the majority's demographic drowning or all kinds of silliness that we hear these days, which is just terrible, because I find that immigration is already such an extremely difficult process. Like, why do we insist on never learning from our history, and history that clearly shows that immigrants always tend to integrate quite well and contribute? And we continue to make it such a hard, like an even harder process for the people coming in now, the new waves of immigrants.
Yeah, that's right. The data shows that immigration is so beneficial.
Exactly. Like, there's nothing new here. You know, I'm not like, I wrote an entire chapter, Plus ça change, to kind of demonstrate point by point by point, well, as much as I could, because at some point I couldn't include every single anecdote or every single example from every ethnic group or wave of immigration. But I tried as much as possible to kind of point to a lot of this anti-immigration legislation that Canada enacted, because it's not just Quebec, obviously. I live in Quebec, so a lot of the book is Quebec-based, but Canada wasn't much better back in the day either. We're kind of better now, trying to be a lot more open of immigration. And I think, as a general rule, the federal government understands the value of immigration and what it brings to the country and how much we rely on it, right? For our labor source and all kinds of different reasons. But if you look at that chapter, I point to such blatant kind of, they're almost laughable today. You know, they're almost like, you look at some of the politicians, the reasoning for not letting people in, you know, whether it was Italians or the Jewish community, or, and you just, you want to cringe because it's so blatantly ridiculous, you know, and xenophobic. But the reality is, here we are in 2022, and I still hear the same nonsense. You know, maybe sometimes it's more subtle, or it's voiced in a different way, that someone can argue that, oh, you know, I'm not against immigration, I'm just, you know, I want the right kind of immigrant. But at the end of the day, it's the same old xenophobia and the same old kind of anti-immigration rhetoric, just wrapped up in a prettier bow. You know, it's based on the same arguments, really.
For somebody coming here who's already facing challenges, that poses kind of unnecessary extra challenges and judgments, not only by people in Canada and Quebec, but by the government or certain politicians or parties themselves. So it's interesting to look at why people want to immigrate, which you do in We the Others. I think unpacking that shows that people who are often coming here are people who want to do more or need to escape a repressive situation, but everyone has their own reasons. And then everyone has their own experience of immigration, though there are similar systemic threads that run through those.
I mean, immigration is immigration. It's what it's always been, right? I mean, the world is not a fair place. It's completely random that we were born here, or I'm assuming you were born here. I don't know if you were, but it's completely random that I was born here and I wasn't born in a war-torn country, and or I wasn't, you know, I'm not a Syrian refugee, or I'm not, you know, a refugee coming from an African country. Like, this is just dumb luck. I'm not more deserving, you're not more deserving than a refugee or an asylum seeker coming in, desperately trying to start their life again, right? And escape poverty, war, genocide, you name it, whatever, religious persecution or anything else. It's just dumb luck. And so it's how immigration has always operated. You know, people will always travel, will always move. People who are in a place where there are very few opportunities, or there's war, or there's whatever is making them want to leave, will pick up and leave. I mean, and they'll go where they feel that there are better opportunities. I mean, North America has always relied on immigration. It's how it operates, right? I mean, the US and Canada are countries that desperately need immigration. We need it. We're large countries. You know, Canada is a vast country that we have an aging population. Quebec, there are more people retiring now than are entering the workforce. We have a low birth rate. We are not having, you know, six, seven, eight, 10 kids per family like they used to have back in the day. So you need more people to replenish, the workforce. Some of these reasons are very basic, right? They're very just numbers game. It's kind of like these are the facts. We need X amount of people to continue having a workforce and a population paying taxes in order to continue financing all the things that we're so proud about. We like to talk about, lately we've been having some major issues here as well with our, universal health care and all those issues. But we like to talk about, I'll focus here just on Quebec. I mean, we like to talk about our almost free daycare and universal access to health care and all these opportunities that people have to have a better life and to have a more equitable kind of access to the good things in life. But well, those things don't come out of nowhere. Like you and I as taxpayers are funding those things. Whether I have kids or not, my property taxes are going into school taxes and they're going into daycare access and they're funding all of these things that benefit people that may not have access to these things. And so, in order to continue having these things, we need people. It's as simple as that. There's no big mystery, surrounding some of these things. It's pretty basic. And when I hear people having like this resistance and talking about how, like, oh, we can't let more people in and we don't have the capacity. It's nonsense because these things, whatever happens in the government or whatever decisions are made, they don't randomly just happen. The decision to fund more housing or to fund more whatever infrastructure is needed or more towards education or French courses or whatever. These are not random decisions. They are very specific decisions that are made by the government based on what the population signals they consider important. So for us to sit here and say, well, we don't have the capacity is a lie because we do have the capacity. We have the money. It just needs to be allocated where it needs to be spent. Recently, we just found out that the federal government had allocated something like $700 million to go towards the Ministère de Francisation to help immigrants and newcomers access free and easily accessible French courses. And we found out that the CEQ only allocated 25% of that money. So I'm sorry, there's a double, like we say, a double discours here. Like, on the one hand, you can't say we don't have the ability, we don't have the capacity to do these things, and we can't accept more people because we don't have the capacity to have these courses and to integrate them properly. And on the other hand, make a very specific decision, a calculated decision, to only spend like a quarter of the money that's sent to you specifically for this purpose. So there's something wrong here. Something doesn't add up.
These systems constantly change, and there are some fundamental aspects of these systems that we require, and there are some that we've simply gotten used to, but could or should change.
Exactly. I mean, we talk about how I don't understand this resistance. We need people. There are, I don't know how many billions of dollars we're losing in lost productivity when it comes to the agricultural sector right now. And people sometimes will jump in and talk about immigration or be very easily swayed by pundits' arguments or saying, oh, but they're a threat to us, or we can't handle, and where are we going to house these people, and where are they going to be? But when it comes down to actually paying attention to what, or they'll be swayed very easily by, like, a politician quick slogan and saying, well, this is how we live here, and this is how we, comme ça qu'on vit à Québec, or whatever, and we promised that we would reduce immigration by 20%, and we did it. But what they're not noticing is that there's a crazy amount of temporary workers that have been admitted under the Legault administration, because the reality is you can say whatever you want, but at the end of the day, we need people. And even a government that, was voted in with a promise to decrease immigration still knows that they need people. So what they've done is they've increased radically the number of temporary workers that are coming in to work here. So they're not technically immigrants, but these people are coming in working, in the fields and the agricultural sector, doing all these things that we desperately need people to do. But these people are actually being taken advantage in many respects because they are working under the most vulnerable conditions. They have no access to, because they're not real immigrants, right? They're temporary workers. So they don't have any necessary like benefits. They can't access like subsidized daycare for their kids. They often are exploited by their bosses because their bosses take advantage of the fact that these people want to be here and they may not have access to resources or help or legal help if something is going wrong, or they won't say anything, right? I think we're being very, like, the people who are actually claiming that they're concerned about immigration or they're concerned about welcoming the right kind of immigrant, they're not being honest. They're not being honest with their arguments, and they're not being honest with themselves, because they still want, like you mentioned earlier, access to all of the things that we've become accustomed to and we want. Like if tomorrow Legault said, hey, we're not accepting any more immigrants, but bye-bye subsidized daycare, I'm pretty sure we'd have riot on our hands. You can't, on the one hand, want access and expect access to all of these things, and on the other hand, not understand that we need a continuous kind of stream of people coming in to actually make this system that we have keep on working the way it is.
In your book, there's a part where you talk about how most people who come here want to stay. And then there's a story about one person you encountered who didn't want to stay in Quebec, and they came from France and had expected something different of Quebec.
I didn't make that story up. I swear it's the honest truth. I have a habit of always talking to people when I take an Uber or a taxi, because I find their stories endlessly fascinating. And most of the time, you know, like 90% of the time, they happen to be immigrants. They happen to be new arrivals because it's an easy job to do. Well, easy. It's not easy, but it's easy to access.
Exactly.
It's easy to start, you know, and you can make some money and, you know, it's flexible so they can continue going to school or doing other things. So, and that was the honest truth. That guy was like, nope, I've already signed a lease. I'm leaving with my family. We're leaving in a couple of weeks because I am not interested in having the government dictate to me where I'm going to send my kid. Like, he wasn't in favor of Bill 101. He wanted to go to Ontario because he wanted his kid to have access to whatever education he deemed, you know, fit or whatever that was. Since then, I have to say I've encountered quite a few immigrants, some of them permanent residents, some of them immigrants who came here from France, and a lot of them left the province and went to other provinces because Quebec made it so difficult for them to actually get their permanent residency that they were like, I'm done, I'm out of here. People who desperately wanted to stay in Quebec because they liked it here and because of the language, I mean, they're francophone, right? Which makes zero sense to me that we're making it so difficult that even the ideal immigrant that the, you know, and I say ideal because that doesn't exist in my book, but I'm using it as what the government considers ideal, someone who is francophone and comes from France, because in their minds, these are people who would integrate more easily and would have an easier time, you know, fitting in because the value system is the same and all that. A lot of these people have left because they were like, I can't, they're making it so difficult for me and I don't feel valued and I feel like I'm just getting the runaround. And they left. I have friends and former colleagues who left and went out to Saskatchewan because it was a lot easier for them to actually get their permanent residency in other provinces. We're losing people.
That's particularly difficult when we're looking at families who come here or people who come here to start families and they have a family and all the challenges of that. And then they also feel this sense of frustration about immigration. And then there are children who live that out and absorb that, including the experience of a new school and a new language. These really make a strong impression. It's difficult for both kids and parents. You talk about language in your book too, of course, and this is one of the major challenges in more than one way, understanding the French language and Quebecois culture. When you look at political initiatives to protect language and culture, like Bill 101, Bill 21, Bill 96, what do you see?
Where do I begin?
Yeah.
I think, let me just preface everything by saying I do support Bill 101. I understand the reason for it. I do believe that cultural and linguistic insecurity exists in Quebec, and a lot of it is very justified. And I have a lot of empathy for a lot of these issues. And I understand, just like any minority, really, I understand a minority's desire to maintain their culture and their language and to fight hard for it. You know, what I find ironic is that people who fight so hard to maintain their culture and language should have some empathy for the people, for everyone else who's also trying to do the same. That's where I find sometimes a lack of kind of understanding, you know, that it's all the same, really. So I do support Bill 101. I understand the reasoning, and I also think it works really well. It has. It's shown. The stats show it very clearly. More French is spoken in the province than ever before, if you compare to like the 60s or the before Bill 101. You know, Bill 101 managed to create bilingual Anglophones, trilingual Allophones. It's a wonderful thing, really, to be exposed to another language. More will always be better than less. I'm sorry, when it comes to languages and cultures, like, it's a beautiful thing to have access to another world and to another language and to enrich yourself individually and career-wise and culturally, you know, in so many levels. Now where we start having issues for me is that, unfortunately, a lot of this kind of linguistic insecurity manifests itself into these very unreasonable demands. You know, it's no longer about Will you please make an effort to speak French, which I think is a very understandable expectation of new arrivals of immigrants, whether they come from another province or come from another country. I think it's a perfectly understandable ask. And I think most people, they do that. I don't think anyone moves here with some built-in resistance to not want to learn French and to not adapt and integrate into a new culture. Why would they be coming here? You know, it's completely ridiculous to think that they would be coming here and not be making the effort. Most people want to learn. People do not learn at the same speed. You know, people need to understand that it's very different when someone comes here, let's say, with an education or access to money to be able to say, I will spend a year just working, you know, taking lessons and not have to worry about how I'm paying my bills. And there's a huge difference between that person who may have been recruited here from some like high tech company saying, hey, we're going to make sure that you have access to all of these things. And some asylum seeker who's coming here already traumatized with the weight of the world on their shoulders and being told, oh, by the way, we're sorry that you went through all this, but you have 6 months before the only way you can communicate with the government or with your kids' teachers or whatever will solely be in French. It's such a lack of empathy for what these people are going through. And it's completely unreasonable, first of all. It's almost like not only do people not learn a language in 6 months and be able to, and we're not talking about, hey, how are you? You know, you bump into the street or the silly little pleasantries. We're talking about, hey, your bill came in from Hydro-Québec. Can someone explain this to me? This is the teacher's report. This is a contract you need to sign with a landlord, and it's only in French. It's absurd to me that someone would be comfortable defending something like this. Either you're completely clueless about what the immigration experience is, or you just don't care. You're lacking in empathy if you're defending something like this. So to me, Bill 96, and it's not all of Bill 96, there are certain things about Bill 96 that I do agree with and I'm perfectly okay with, but there are certain elements of it that I have huge issues with, and that is one of them for sure. And to me, those elements, it's not about language, it's not about fitting in, it's more about, it's almost like we're penalizing you for not speaking French before you get here, practically. It's like a signal, don't even bother, or you're better off not applying here or coming here if you don't speak French, because we don't have the patience and the confidence to believe that you will pick it up and that you will want to learn it and that you will love it. There's a real lack of confidence I find here in Quebec culture. And I know that it comes from historic facts and certain issues and the relationship that Quebecers have with the rest of Canada that is deeply ingrained in them, where they, it's a relationship of méfiance, you know, like they're always, they don't trust it. There's a deep insecurity and a lack of faith and confidence that their language is being supported in any way. And I get some of it because historically they are right to feel that way. But at the same time, there are many, many reasons to also feel that their language is supported. You know, we are officially a bilingual country. Canada annually spends billions, quadrillions, I don't know how much money to maintain an officially bilingual country. We want more French immigration. The government has said that they want more French immigration. Can more be done? Absolutely. You know, but that is not enough of a reason to be penalizing people who come here. As if you're saying, well, you know what, Francophones are not necessarily treated the way we would want them to be treated. And it's like almost like Quebec often ignores Francophones and the rest of Canada unless they can use them for their own political games. And it really ticks me off. And I know of a lot of Francophones in the rest of Canada who feel that way, who often feel thrown under the bus by Quebec because they only remember them when they can use them as leverage to say, hey, you know what, we treat Anglophones so much better. Because look at how Francophones are being treated over there. The dynamics are, and I've said this before many times, and I probably can't remember. I think I probably wrote about it in the book. From a journalistic point of view, from a punditry point of view, as someone who writes about all these issues, it's super fascinating to be seeing all of these dynamics at play. But it's also extremely exhausting. There are days where I just want to like chuck my computer out the, you know, throw it off my balcony and turn all social media off, because it becomes really tiring to have to constantly justify your place, you know, and to justify your your right to exist here and your right to criticize issues that come up and government legislation that impacts you and impacts your community. Like, I have the right to criticize without being told that I'm not as much of a Quebecer because my last name isn't Tremblay or because I work in English. These are not reasons that make me less of a Quebecer. I'm just as much of a Quebecer as someone who's been here, you know, eight generations and only speaks French. Like, there are this notion that if you don't check these specific boxes, you're not a real Quebecer is really annoying to me, you know? And it's honestly, it's discriminatory and it makes people feel like they don't belong.
It is exhausting. And one of the ways you put it in the book is, let us be ordinary immigrants. Let immigrants not have to be exceptional or heroic, not always having to prove themselves. You tell a story in the book about a woman who becomes the first Black borough mayor in Montreal, in Côte-des-Neiges, Notre-Dame-de-Grâce. And she talks about her father and growing up in Quebec as the child of immigrant parents, that she was always striving for great things, partly because of that experience, which is wonderful, but not everyone needs to do that, even if they feel a certain social pressure or expectation to go above and beyond to be that kind of model immigrant.
I think for me, it's not so much that by now we're surrounded by immigrants. All of us know people who are first or second generation or third generation that are contributing in so many amazing ways to their homes. So I feel like we shouldn't even be having these conversations, but it's this expectation, as I talk about, this expectation of gratitude that is toxic. Because again, there's this hierarchy at play. You're basically saying, well, you're not as deserving to be here as this person who was born here or has been here, you know, just because their ancestors caught the earlier boat. Really, that's all it is, you know. Like, no, none of us are from here other than, you know, Indigenous communities. So this notion that I'm somehow more deserving because my parents came here a few generations before yours is such nonsense to me. The same way I would never turn to someone who just came here and said, well, I deserve, my opinion matters more, or my opinion has more gravitas because I've been here an additional generation or two. Like, no, it doesn't work that way. So for me, this expectation, this demand that you contribute more, that you do more, that you need to justify your presence here. Yeah, it's toxic and it's dangerous. And I kind of, for me, because often we do that, we don't even realize when we do it. And it's not malicious always, right? Like, we'll say like, oh, you know, but this athlete is, you know, an immigrant, or his parents were immigrants, and look what he did now. It's kind of to show that immigration is a good thing and how quickly the second generation, third generation contributes and gives back in so many ways. And it's not malicious, but it was also to kind of point out that not everyone that we let in has to have a PhD or is an economic migrant and has to have 50, you know, Legault says has to be making at least $56,000 when Quebecers don't even make that. That's not the average salary here either. So this notion that all of a sudden someone who's coming from elsewhere has to make that, you know, reach that amount is just ludicrous to me. But also to kind of point out to the ordinary people like my dad, you know, like he worked in restaurants, you know, he was an ordinary immigrant. Nobody will be writing, you know, like I said, these grandiose obituaries about him. People will not remember him other than his family. And there's thousands and thousands of ordinary immigrants that make, just like my dad and my mom, who make our society work, who make sure that everything is running the way it's supposed to be running, you know, whether it's the owner of your favorite restaurant or the bus driver or the teachers and orderlies in hospitals, who saved our butts during the pandemic. Like, the fact that our memories are this short, that one minute we're calling them our guardian angels and the next minute the government is like, oh, sorry, you know, we can't let you in, or unless you specifically worked on this front line, I don't care that you were risking your life working over here, because we need to limit the number of people that are coming in, even though these people have already proven to us that all they want to do is work and contribute, and we need people to be doing these jobs. Like, it's so such a waste of energy and time that we're actually having these debates when it's a win-win for everyone.
Let's talk more about that second generation, the kids of immigrants. And you're one too. You write that second generation kids are different from other kids. Why is that? And what are the challenges for second generation children?
I feel like there's still probably another couple of books in me because I feel like there's so much to talk about these issues, right? And this book was initially, the manuscript was initially much longer. And working with my editors, they were like, you got to limit it at some point. We just have to, you know, there's only so much you can talk about. So we had to kind of squeeze everything in. But yeah, I mean, the first and second generation are radically different. How could they not be? Their experiences are completely different, right? The second generation have it much, much better, much, much easier. You know, I have nothing but gratitude for how difficult, you know, the circumstances were for my parents and how much they did in order for us to have a better life. We are born and raised in a society, in a community. We go to school here. Of course, and again, the second and the third generation are very different as well. To me, my experience was always, especially, and again, like I can't generalize, but because my parents didn't have a lot of education, what happens as a result is that, like, my parents both speak French and English. You know, my dad spoke French and English, but it was a rudimentary French and English, right? It was basic. My mom too, you know, my mom's still around. She's someone who loves, she's very social. She loves to talk to people, loves to her neighbor, speaks to her neighbors, but her French and English is very basic, right? She'll try to kid around and it'll be like, she can't necessarily read a lot, you know, like she can read the basic, you know, get her groceries done, find out where she was going when she was driving. She no longer drives, but when she was driving, you know, see where she's going. But like I mentioned in my book, they'll never, you know, my mom will never read this book. They never read, you know, read my columns because their, you know, their language, linguistic skills in English and French are limited. So I was used to, as a second generation, and I know a lot of second generation kids will relate to this, of being that de facto translator, that person who would be decrypting everything that'd be coming in, or that person who goes with your mom to the doctors to make sure that she is getting the right information and she's understanding what's happening, right? It's what we do. It's how we were raised. It's you know, you want to help your parents, obviously, as they're getting older to make sure that they understand. I'd go visit my mom and she'd be like, oh, this came in the mail. I think I understand what it means, but can you take a look at it just to make sure, right? So it's just a reality. You know, growing up, I didn't have any help with my homework. Who was going to help me? I was on my own. You know, I learned to be very self-sufficient from a very young age because A, they were almost never there. They were working all the time. So I was a latchkey kid from a very young age. And also even when they were there and they wanted to help, you know, like my dad would help me with my Greek homework when I did, you know, I did Greek school because obviously, you know, his Greek was better than his English, but I had no one to help me, you know? So it's kind of like, it's a lonely place to be at times because you also, like, you understand that your realities are so different that as much as you love them and as much as you know they love you, that there's an element of, you know, like I say in the book, you'll never quite meet, you know, because there's certain things that you'll never quite understand about each other to a certain degree. I think those experiences are not unique to my family. They're not unique to my community. There's something that is probably very familiar to a lot of first generation, second generation immigrants.
Yeah, and then that third generation might seem to have even more remove, but also has a different perspective on the exploration of culture too.
I mean, like I say in the book, kids and parents already have this generational gap, right, where they won't always agree on a lot of things and they just live in completely different worlds. But when it comes to immigrants, immigrant parents and their kids, the differences are much wider than that and larger because you're not just kind of dealing with different generations, you're dealing with completely different worlds in many respects. And the one thing that I've noticed, because for me, it's been an interesting kind of experience growing up because I was born here and I lived here until I was like 10, 10 and a half. And then we moved to Greece. So I lived there for another decade, like most of my formative years, you know, teenager, equivalent of CEGEP, you know, university, you know, in Greece. So I came back when I was like 21. At that point, you're pretty much a almost fully formed adult. I mean, you're still learning, you're not quite there, but your formative years, you know, my formative years were spent in Greece. And there's a huge difference between Greeks and Greece and Greek Canadians, Greek Montrealers, because what happens with immigrant communities in many respects is that they tend to almost traditionally, they hold on to the traditions in a way where they kind of stay stuck in a specific time and place sometimes. they're even more traditional than your typical Greek back home. Like the Greek community here, in some respects, when it comes to religion and comes to traditions and how important certain things are, is still like kind of not everyone, of course, and everyone is different and everyone places a different value to, you know, how much they want their kids to speak Greek and follow the traditions. But as a general rule, I find that a lot of them tend to be more traditional and they're still kind of stuck in the 60s and 70s when they first came here. And that's how they raised their kids. So that value system is really like it's been passed down. So I have a lot of Greek Canadian friends who are very into their Greek culture and really they would never dream of not sending their kids to Greek school. And religion is a huge part of it. And they want to go to, you know, they go to church and they go to the festivals and they go. And here I am, like, not a very typical, you know, I lived in Greece for many years and I'm like, never wanted kids. I'm not very traditional. I was an atheist by the time I was like 6 or 7. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of Greeks are like, I don't know what to do with this one. You know, I can't figure her out. And there were many, many times in my life where my mom would kind of look at me like I was a complete stranger, you know, like she couldn't quite figure me out either.
Hearing you say that, I need to ask about the title of the book, We the Others. What is the other? Is it okay to be other? But also the title speaks to both individuality and being part of a community, within a nation. It's about both belonging and not belonging to multiple communities and identities.
I was very adamant about this title. I fell in love with it. I thought about it and I was like, I really love it. It feels kind of like a statement in some respects. And for me, it was also play on words because, you know, allophones comes from allos, which is a Greek word for other. And I really wanted this book to be about othering and how counterproductive it is to be othered and to be made to feel like you don't belong in your world, in your place of, that you consider home. But and how people will other you, right? By insisting that unless you fit like these specific criteria, then you're not a real majority member. You don't qualify as a real Quebecer. So then by nature, you become othered. You are othered. So it's interesting to see how people are perceiving the title and how what they read into it, because people are seeing, you know, they'll read what they want to read into it. For me, it's primarily about, and it was also play on chez nous, you know, because I wanted to play a little bit about that. Like, is this my chez nous too? Am I a part of the nous when we talk about the nous, you know? But also about primarily about being othered. And as you mentioned, it's okay to be different because I feel that in Quebec, often there's this real, it's political often, but this desire, this need to kind of promote homogeneity, to kind of like we have to be politically interculturalism is something that's promoted. They're not big on multiculturalism because they feel that it would kind of dilute the French factor. So there's this desire to kind of think the same and act the same. And the more we all kind of walk in the same direction, that we, this is how we'll be a more successful Quebec, where people will integrate better if they assimilate. You know, there's this demand, like now how we're having conversations, like the goalposts keep changing and the debates now are like, well, people are learning French, but what are they speaking at home? Well, it's none of your business what I speak at home, because as long as I speak French, I can continue to be speaking a million, like I'm sorry, but when French Quebecers go to live 6 months in Florida, for example, do they not speak French at home? Are they speaking English or Spanish? No, I'm pretty sure they're speaking French. And it's perfectly normal because that's your mother tongue. When we talk about the decline of French, we need to be very careful about what we're looking at. And we need to make sure that we're being honest with ourselves and say, if people are learning French and people know how to communicate in French, it's nobody's business what other languages they also know in conjunction with that one. I mean, honestly, the title was about a lot of things, you know, I kind of wanted people to kind of read a lot of different things into it.
It's a title that really grabs you and makes you think about what othering is, that it is in many ways kind of a spectrum and even another way to cultivate empathy, as you've mentioned already in this conversation. I really enjoyed the book's mix of storytelling and politics and that you're really talking about a reality that many people are living right now, and that we're hearing on the news too, of course. So thank you very much for bringing that in.
Yeah, absolutely. I really wanted it to be very accessible, you know, to people. I didn't want them bored. I didn't want it to be too academic. And I wanted to really weave. I thought I had the unique experience of someone who has been covering politics for a long time, you know, and social issues here in Quebec as a pundit and a journalist, and also someone who is a second generation kid to kind of weave in and out of the personal and the, you know, what's happening in the news, and to kind of give that perspective that maybe is missing sometimes, or people aren't aware of, you know, and to talk about these things in a very accessible way. My hope is that everyone goes into this book with a very open mind, and even if they don't necessarily agree with everything, at least they understand and acknowledge that other perspectives are just as valuable and just as they have a right to exist, you know, and that doesn't make me less of a Quebecer if I'm a Federalist or if I'm whatever. I mean, I consider myself a political orphan at this point, but I'm saying, like, whatever my beliefs are, like, just if I'm against Bill 21, that doesn't make me less of a Quebecer. If I work in English, that doesn't make me less of a Quebecer. If my first language is Greek, that doesn't make me less of a Quebecer. I'm a different version of a Quebecer. Quebec is changing and evolving. It will not stay. The only thing that stays static is dead. So it's perfectly normal that we're evolving and we're changing. And Quebec is just a part of that. The rest of Canada, we're changing. It's inevitable.
It's a constant, and it should be heartening in a way to know that it is. So thank you very much for speaking with me today on In the Motherhood, Tula.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I thought it was fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was an interview with Montreal columnist, writer, and news producer Tula Dramonis, who talked with me about her new book, We the Others, Allophones, Immigrants, and Belonging in Canada. It's published by Linda Leith Publishing here in Montreal, and you can find it wherever you buy books, here or wherever you are. Thanks for listening to In the Motherhood and CKUT. You can get in touch with us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca and on Facebook at ckut-inthemotherhood. It's just about 7 p.m., but stay tuned to CKUT 90.3 FM for some great music and more all night long. Happy holidays, and see you in the new year.
I'm sure it's something good. We'll be right back. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Firoz Manji. Welcome to this monthly broadcast from the Raja Press in collaboration with Amandla Radio. Thank you for joining us today. Some months ago, I hosted a series of 24 lectures on the theme of the African people's struggle for the liberation of Africa. And this was done in collaboration with the China Social Services and Development Research Center, Lingnan University in China, Asian Regional Exchange for New Alternatives, the South-South Forum for Sustainability, the Global University for Sustainability, Southwest University China, Hong Kong University, and the Raja Press. In the